From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation continues with Professor Tony Montero in what may be our first conversation about the 2020 elections. Well, Professor Montero, I looked up today, first of all, remembering about 2 years ago when we went to the RNC and the DNC, looked up the information about the one coming in 2020. Now, 2020, we should be able to see clearly, right? And yes. Sorry for that. And, you know, I guess we've got one is in July and the other in August. They're more than a month apart. The Republicans are in Charlotte, was it? It's in North Carolina, somewhere in one of those states. And the Democrats have, I think, still three cities that they're deciding among. Including was it St. Louis or some one of the smaller Midwestern cities that they've never had it before. So anyway, the drama for the whole 2020 thing is starting to stir in the background to everything else we're going to talk about, which includes Trump at the wall today or whatever at the border, the Pelosi Schumer press conference following up after Trump's presser the other night. Every other crazy thing going on in the world. Pick a place and we'll start there.
Well, the 2020 election has already begun, and it will take place within the midst of the greatest political crisis in almost 160 years, and probably maybe the greatest political crisis in the history of the country. This will be the most unusual election, at least in modern times. It has all of the aspects of not just a great drama, but the fracturing of the political system itself, and I believe one, if not both, of the major political parties will disintegrate right before our very eyes. And now, you know, the Democrats, with about 25 people having announced or getting ready to announce, will probably show the greatest fracturing of either party. And we see already these factions, the young guard, so-called socialists, so-called progressives, versus the old guard, the Pelosis and the Schumers, and those connected most securely to the big money donors of the Democratic Party. I see this as a fight to the death within the Democratic Party. I think for the most part, the Republicans will remain not the Republican Party, but really the Trump Party. And so that's where it's going to be fought. It's going to get nasty. It's going to get ugly. And we can't rule out, if not a major recession, at least a mild recession, which will increase the sense of insecurity and uncertainty among the working people of the United States. So I look forward to this. It's going to bring to the fore all of the great contradictions that affect a late capitalist society like our own. And the ripples from it, of course, will affect the politics in all of the major capitalist countries.
You know, when you talk about this election taking place in the midst of a crisis like that, of that 160-year magnitude, I just did a quick lookup of the 1860 and 1864 elections. And it's very curious things here that people, I've forgotten some of this just looking at the skin of it. You know, there were four candidates in 1860 when Abraham Lincoln was elected.
Yeah.
And he was elected with only 39.8% of the popular vote. There were two Democratic candidates. Stephen Douglas was a Northern Democrat, and John Breckinridge was a Southern Democrat. And between the two of them, they got about 2.2 million popular votes to Lincoln's 1.865 million popular votes. And but because of the nature of the Electoral College and the relative populations, Lincoln had 180 electoral votes, and between them, Breckinridge and Douglas only had 84. Mm-hmm. So, and Douglas had only 12 electoral votes, even though he had 1.38 million popular votes, and Breckinridge had 72 electoral votes as opposed to 12, and he had only 848,000. In other words, he had two-thirds of the popular vote that Douglas had, and he had six times the number of electors. So that was in 1860. Then 4 years later, in the midst of the Civil War, it's only two candidates because the South was seceded, and it was closer. George McClellan got 45% of the popular vote, and Lincoln 55%. This is, you know, with the Civil War raging. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mm-hmm. it was pretty interesting stuff.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And we're facing a crisis of that magnitude again, and elections take on strange dynamics in the midst of political crises. Well, I don't know if we can predict the outcome. What we can predict is an intense struggle. The question is, what role will the masses of people play? Will they sit on the sideline and just observe this through CNN and podcasts and MSNBC and Fox? Or will there be active organizing, for example, for peace in the sense of actual withdrawal from Syria, actual withdrawal from Afghanistan? Will there be a demand, for example, to cease shipment of military equipment to Israel? Will there be a discussion of a comprehensive immigration policy? And really, will the question of infrastructure development and a jobs and anti-poverty program find its way into the debate? I am hoping that in this period, this year or so before the 2020 election, that people begin to organize and hold town halls and other kinds of meetings on a grassroots level, that the unions begin to discuss the issues that confront the working class. I think this could present an opportunity for the grassroots, both in the labor movement and in the communities, to make their voices heard and through their actions and discussions to determine the directions of this election.
You know, that's a very good point. I'm looking at the claim of, Russian hand directing, not just a little Russian influence in the 2016 mm-hmm. election, but mm-hmm. Russia determined who our president is. That's mm-hmm. Not even subtext of all of these Russiagate claims. Mm-hmm. But the fact pattern it rests on is, tens of thousands of dollars of Facebook ads and whatever. Which is laughable compared to a $2 billion electoral budget and all the airtime that everybody got that had nothing mm-hmm. to do with Russia. The day before yesterday, I saw an article in the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, the same guy that owns Amazon, as we know. Mm-hmm. And it was a propaganda piece slandering China. The headline itself carried with it the implicit claim, I think the explicit claim, actually, that China has gulags for Muslims inside mm-hmm. China. And because I think that was the actual title of it, like China's Gulags for Muslims or something. So it occurred to me, now if you look at the last week, the week before, Apple utters that they might not sell as many iPhones, and the Dow plummets like 600-700 points. You mm-hmm. know, look, people look at it like, oh my God, are the markets going to go into a free fall over mm-hmm. that? China, it occurred to me, and I posted something mischievously to my Facebook page about this, but it really started a conversation. I'm China, and Bezos is slandering me in the newspaper, clearly attempting to meddle in my internal affairs in a way that is much more heavy-handed, and by the way, with a much more heavy-handed tradition coming from the United States than anything anybody could accuse anybody of inside doing to the United States. And that they're looking to establish a regime change with this propaganda. Well, suppose, and now we have the Helms-Burton Act style sanctions as a precedent now established by the United States. If we wanted to throw an embargo around Cuba, not only do you have to stay away from Cuba, but you have to stay away from anybody that didn't stay away from Cuba, or you got to stay away from the whole world. Like, in other words, we can isolate you for doing business with somebody that does business with somebody we say you can't do business with. And I'm thinking, okay, let's take those rules and even bring them in a generation closer to the vest. Let's say China decides, because Jeff Bezos is slandering us and looking in coordination with the U.S. to do regime change in our country, we're going to sanction Amazon. They cannot carry any product manufactured in China that's manufactured any place that's been financed by China, that is being sold and or wholesaled or transported or whatever by anybody that has anything to do with China, cannot sell to Amazon. Now, if this talk about the iPhones sent the markets into a dive because the sales were off by 10%, what would China saying and proving to the world, Amazon, you cannot sell any more Chinese goods or any goods that had any trade with China at all? That's like Amazon can't sell anything, in other words. It turns into like a Soviet store in 1989 or something. What do you think? What kind of power is that China could drop? You know, you say, you know, one of the influences on the election might be, you know, whatever is going on with the economy. Suppose China decided to drop that, like in October of 2020, the kind of influence that they could have. And so when you're talking about the unrest in the country, you suddenly have a prospect of an inside-outside game.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a dangerous game. And because China, even with the slowdown, is, if not now, will in the next year or two, be the largest economy in the world.
Yep.
The global economy will, in large measure, be dependent upon what happens in China. I think that the ruling class of the United States is without a vision and are desperate. The internal struggle within the ruling class, and actually, I think the more intense one is between the ruling class and the people, this struggle has driven a good part of the American elite mad, crazy, and that is a factor. And so what we have to prevent or hope to avoid is they're doing something desperate, like a military confrontation with China or Russia. It is not insignificant that based upon Trump's announcement of withdrawing the 2,000 troops from Syria and 7,000 from Afghanistan and all of the implications of those withdrawals, that Mattis was fired and General Zinni just resigned from his position as ambassador to Qatar. I think it's Qatar. So now we have not only the FBI, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the other nine or so intelligence services of the United States in lockstep opposition to Trump, but increasingly the generals withdrawing from his administration and signing petitions or ads that say that he is making a mistake, that he's endangering American security, and on and on and on. These people are capable of doing desperate things in desperate times. And that is why the action of the people is so important. I would just put it that way. I hear what you're saying. There's hysteria from people like Bezo and probably others, but that's the situation that we face at this point. Right. They begin to act as though the political crisis is in fact, as I have suggested, an existential crisis of the political system.
Yeah. Here's another example of exactly that question in what has to be obvious meddling by the UK. This is the Guardian newspaper today. What is America going to do about its Trump problem in 2019? The subheading, removing Donald Trump is essential, but to fully address the work that needs to be done, his appointees must also step down. This is instructions from London, basically, to the American government. So it's going to be quite a pot being stirred.
Oh, no. I would not underestimate the critical nature of the situation that we're confronted with. You know, some people who have been generally progressive are making arguments that look like Bernie Sanders or Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, that the place that we must all go is to the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party must hear the voices of its so-called left wing. I think that is a losing strategy from the beginning. What we need is independent political action of the people that forces anybody that enters this race to respond to the demands of the people for peace and justice and economic prosperity, which means a poverty infrastructure program, a green ecological New Deal. But at the core, there must be peace and the cut in the military budget significantly. So any other discussion, I think, leads nowhere. It constitutes a capitulation to the ruling class and really to the most warlike elements of the ruling class who are presenting themselves as candidates of the people while still holding tightly to their position of war and endless wars abroad.
Yeah. I mean, in a condition of disintegration, of delegitimization, of chaos, you have the hardest push, the most belligerent foreign policy that perhaps imaginable being unleashed. And actually, that's the weapon that they want to use to smash what remains of the constitutional government in the country. Donald Trump is not fit to be the president, despite the fact that he was elected, because he's an agent of Russia. And therefore, we can, and the Russians are basically trying to do away with our constitutional system. So in order to protect ourselves against that, we have to disregard our constitutional system and remove Trump by any means necessary.
That's right. That's right. And this is the worst form of McCarthyism and Cold War propaganda. I mean, it harkens back to the worst days of the 1950s. And for so-called liberals and progressives and even leftists to join that type of parade is, in fact, heresy, apostasy. It is a betrayal of all that they say they are supposed to be about. Now, that means that this period that we're entering into is going to have to also be contain an ideological and political struggle within the left and progressive forces. And the truth must prevail. There cannot be this hiding behind the Democrats should do X, Y, and Z. Well, let's be real. The Democrats are not going to do anything but what they have done in the past. It remains the party of the neocons and the neoliberals more so now than in 2016. I mean, let's get it real. It is the party of war. And all of the generals, all of the deep state operatives that abandoned the Republicans and Trump are now in the Democratic Party. That's the big tent.
And I remember the, was it the 2012 election? Mm-hmm. When they, in essence, announced the death of the Republican Party. It might have even been first in 2008 because the Democrats had recaptured both houses of Congress, and then Obama was elected president, and they retained or expanded for the first, for the year 2008, the majorities in the House and Senate. Now you have people writing about Trump was able to find a path to the White House through the remains of the Republican Party, the debris of it, and that, in other words, that this condition did exist. The Republican Party was finished, and out of the ashes comes Donald Trump. Well,
right.
They're saying the same thing about the Democratic Party now, and they seem hell bent on, as they mobilize, the most right-wing reactionary forces and express them through the Democratic Party, one thing that they're doing is creating the same kind of condition that the Republicans did when they had the most, backwards, right-wing Christian maniacs spewing in 2012, that some new voice that actually talks some sense might get the support of the constituency. What do you see in terms of that?
Well, see, I think it's hard to compare 2012 to 2020 or even 2016. Yeah. I mean, we're in the throes of a crisis the likes of which has not been seen in this country for almost 160 years. I mean, and that is the backdrop to everything. Now, of course, at the same time, the global economy is slowing down. How deep the recession that is coming will be, no one can fully predict. I know one thing, the stock markets are very jittery. That can tell you something about how the financial oligarchs and elites look upon the future. But that having been said, the deepest crisis is in the political system. And when you look at polling about people's attitudes towards the press, towards the Congress, towards almost every major institution of the country, they show very low approval ratings by the people. I mean, in the 20s and below. That is what we call, and I've said this before, a legitimation crisis. And it is made even worse by the fact that the center has collapsed. The vital center has collapsed. And people like Richard Haass of the Foreign, the Council on Foreign Relations is now talking about how to manage the dismemberment of the American empire, how to manage it. And if he's talking about it here, in Germany and France and England and throughout Europe, elites are also discussing that as well. And perhaps the crisis is worse in Europe because the single currency, the euro, might be abandoned by country after country. And if that happens, then you're looking at a whole new political and economic situation in Europe. The other side of it is, with all of the attacks upon Russia, with all of the sanctions upon Russia, Russia remains stable. And in a lot of ways, Putin and his government can show certain victories, especially in Syria. That is not insignificant. And that is what really bothers a lot of the U.S. elites. The other question is what happens in Ukraine, what and how will the Chinese-Russia strategic alliance go forward? And finally, I would say, what will happen on the Korean Peninsula? This is highly significant. I think the world is trending towards a new configuration where the United States will no longer be, and I think Trump is signaling this, will no longer seek hegemony. The multipolar world is being born out of the ruins of this unipolar world, a situation of 30 years. We don't know what will become of Europe as a whole, but we do know that things look better on the Asian continent than it does in Europe or North America.
Yeah, I mean, I think the competing visions, to use some sort of symbolic language, would be that the existing hegemonic drive and project, would be that the United States is the king of the world, and Trump sees maybe the United States being like the boss of all bosses, like first among equal, something like that. In other words, more it's a more of a collegial, form of domination.
One would hope so.
Well, it seems like that's a multipolar. In other words, that would be the symbolic representation of multipolarity as opposed to hegemony.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So that now you have like that struggle that's driving a lot of this. That's the foundation of a lot of this. You have the intense contradictions just generally in terms of the crisis of legitimacy that you talk about, the continuing austerity, the hollowing out of things. You have a contradiction also shaping up or becoming remanifest maybe between the real economy and the financialized economy, where you might see like the markets look terrible and maybe interest rates not be favorable, but people having jobs and things, and so the economy itself, being better for the people that are going to go vote. Yeah, interest rates are terrible, but I got a job and I just had a turkey, and so we're going to vote for you.
Yeah.
Then that's kind of weird, but you've got things like the Atlantic, for example. Colleges are no match for American poverty. All of the things that people expected before are way out of reach now. Now all of that mixes into this.
Yeah, you have to include it all. You have to do a holistic analysis, as they in sociology says, a multivariate analysis.
Right.
And there are so many factors that you literally do need computer programs to kind of predict outcomes based upon how you weigh the various factors, the political crisis versus the world economy, or how they, not versus, but how they interact. So, but then, still, I am convinced that it is people who make history, and so much depends on what the masses of people do. It seems that Trump will be very, very difficult to beat in 2020, but of course the struggle might be over holding on to the House and taking back the Senate, and then going forward with some form of impeachment if he wins, and maybe even a coup d'etat. And you cannot rule out a desperate act of warfare taken without Trump by forces in the military. There's so much that could happen in a crisis like this. But the key is to educate the masses, to prepare the people for whatever comes, and to help them to see what's going on, and then to organize in their class interest.
And that is always the trick, isn't it, Tony?
Yeah,
thank you
the
very
trick,
much.
Always.
I'll speak with you again next week. Thank you, man.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that was the world-renowned Du Boisian scholar from Philadelphia, Professor Anthony Montero. He's featured here weekly, and he came to us via Skype from Philadelphia, Thursday. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.